Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, the final day of class at Jefferson County Public Schools was Wednesday, and we thought this would be a good place for us to kind of hit the reset button on education and JCPS, a lot of issues facing the district. Among them, Superintendent Donna Hargan's first year is coming to a close. The school board has begun her evaluation. There are also proposed changes being suggested to the elementary school assignment plan and other issues facing Kentucky's largest school system. Here to talk about it is Devin Katayama, who covers education for WFPL. Welcome, Devin.
Thanks, Rick. It's good to be here.
We were hoping to have Toni Kahns from the Courier-Journal, who is an education reporter, of course, for the newspaper, but she's had something come up in the newsroom and sends her regrets, and we hope to have her back again soon. Devin, let's start with the evaluation by the school board of Donna Hargan. Superintendent was hired, I guess, last August, right before the start of classes. Some of this is still being done in secret, right?
Yeah, and to be honest, it's hard to believe it's already been a year, but it is that time. Preliminary discussions are being done in executive session, which essentially just means privately. They can do this because in 2010, the state basically passed legislation saying that school districts should, in fact, conduct these preliminary conversations in private. Part of the thinking was behind that was that it would give them freedom to go through the process of evaluation without having a lot of public input. In some circumstances, there's a lot of controversies. The public wants to make a lot of comments. There might be a lot of questions that might delay the whole process. So this was the first. This week was the first meeting that they held. They will hold public meetings this month, and they expect to do that at the next board meeting. But this meeting was in private, and part of that is also the Courier-Journal, a few years ago filed a lawsuit trying to get evaluation access from Sheldon Berman's evaluation. They were unable to. Attorney General at the time did cite the JCPS and have them pay the attorney's fees for that court case. So in that instance, Courier-Journal was a little vindicated.
And there is some difference of opinion among board members as to whether all of this should be done in public or some of it behind closed
doors. Steve Imhoff is the one board member who voted 6-1 that this should be done in public. He was obviously outvoted, but he says he respects the consensus of the board. And a lot of board members say, basically that this is the state law, so this is why we're doing this. They can use that excuse now, but, if you asked them back when this was really controversial, it might have been a different story.
What seems to just your general feel seems to be the general consensus in the community and among us teachers and administrators on her job?
I get the sense that she's doing an all right job. As far as what board members have told me, as far as the her being introduced during a time when the student assignment plan was going on, all these changing assessments, I think the idea behind her strengths are really data-driven. And that seems to be what a lot of people are turning towards in this age where we're kind of toying around with different educational policies and different educational assessments. So far, it seems like there hasn't been any really huge controversies. The only kind of controversial thing that came up this year was the hiring of Jamila Frazier as the chief communications, diversity, and community relations individual. Then it came out that Ms. Frazier had a similar position under a controversial superintendent on the East Coast. Superintendent Hargan's did retract, or excuse me, Jamila Frazier did step down. And when Superintendent Hargan's was asked about it, she still stood by her decision, but she respected Frazier's decision to step down.
You mentioned the student assignment plan. Of course, this has been, for lack of a better term, evolving since the U.S. Supreme Court back in 2007 declared that that plan was unconstitutional, and another plan was put forth. There were complaints about long bus rides, and now there is another version of the plan being proposed, right?
Yeah, I mean, the elementary schools was approved for their plan earlier this year. That will be implemented next year, and just for a brief background, that plan will essentially still look at race, income, and educational attainment, but now it'll look at them within the smaller census blocks, and it'll recognize already existing diversity throughout the district, and it'll also include ESL students in those numbers and kindergarten students in those numbers. So that will be implemented this next school year. Because they were in somewhat of a rush to implement it for the elementary schools, and part of that was from the elementary showcase that was held earlier this year, parents needed to know where their kids were going to go. They decided to take another look at it to see if they would want to implement any of the other recommendations that UCLA professor Gary Orfield, when he came to the district last year, he had a bunch of recommendations. They wanted to revisit those. So that's what they're in the process of, and they're still in discussions. But this week they looked at putting in a 13-cluster plan, which was Orfield's recommendation, for the 2013-2014 school year. And essentially what that means is that students will be they'll have less school choice by about six schools. Right now, parents have about 13, 14 schools they could choose from in their clusters. 13 clusters would mean less school choice, about six or so. It'll also mean less transportation for some students.
And running parallel to all this, we're awaiting a decision from the Kentucky Supreme Court on the argument over whether state law, the interpretation of state law, whether when a student enrolls in a school gives that student the right to actually attend.
Right.
And this goes to the whole concept of neighborhood schools. Right?
Yeah, that'll actually be an interesting one to see. I'm surprised we haven't heard much on that in recent weeks. I was kind of guessing that it would come in a lot sooner.
Yeah.
But that'll be interesting to see what happens, because if they do rule that students have they're able to go to the school closest to their home, my guess is that they'll put in some kind of stipulation where maybe not for this next school year, but maybe future school years. So I'm not quite sure how they're going to act on that.
The school officials have said, well, not everybody can go to the school closest to their homes because we could just create
chaos. Right. They
say,
yeah, exactly. They say there's it's not even possible to,
yeah.
to implement
Well, not
that.
Everyone would want to go to the school.
Exactly. In fact, a lot of when they did make the changes for the student assignment plan, the district haven't had a lot of comments saying that, we don't like this plan, essentially.
Also, during the Donna Hargan's tenure, the short tenure, there's been a reshuffling of front office personnel. How's that been going?
Yeah, everybody's in place right now. They're even going further into that curriculum, the central office restaffing. And that was all part of the curriculum management audit, which the district commissioned, I want to say, 2 years ago, before last year. But it was conducted while Superintendent Hargan's was lead of the district. And that's basically essentially taking the central staff down from a lot of jobs to a core few that are just necessary. And what's happening, for example, in the office of the chief academic officer, Dewey Hensley, that is being divided up with itself to six assistant superintendents throughout the district. So there is still some hiring going on, even though they have condensed it. But that hiring is a lot more concentrated, and everybody on board knows what the mission is going forward. They know what the school wants to get out of those hires.
Well, I have here, let's go across the river to Clark County. This is somewhat related to JCPS because Stephen Dashner was after he left JCPS, he went to Illinois and then came back here to run the Clark County schools. They didn't renew his contract and launched a search for a new superintendent. Where do we stand with that?
They have finished the second round of interviews for the candidates. They narrowed it down from 17 to 5 and then from 5 to 3. They won't name who they are. In fact, the people that are helping them oversee the hiring, which is a couple of universities and the school board association over there in Indiana, don't even want those three to be named. Initially, the board said that they would hold an open forum. Now that's a little more questionable. So we'll actually be reporting on that in the upcoming few days.
All right, Devin Katayama, thanks for joining us live. We're going to hear an interview you did with some JCPS students. Now, as the JCPS students are out for the summer, the last of over 5,000 seniors expected to graduate today. Devin sat down with a few of them to talk about their education, the future, and what they remember most from the past 4 years.
My name is Kelsey Hayden. I went to Southern High School, and I'm going to attend St. Catherine College in the fall.
Does it feel good to say went?
It really does.
Do you remember your first few days of high school and what that was like by any chance?
I guess it was kind of awkward because I would try and talk to people and you don't really know anyone. So they're like, I don't want to talk to you.
We met in freshman year in environmental science class.
This over here is Ernie Barrios. I've known him since freshman year. He's a really cool guy. Valedictorian of Moore High School.
This is my friend Abdullah Jai. He's going to be rooming with me at U of L. He plans on going to study majoring in biology. He stuck scissors into a power outlet and we've fell in love ever since. I don't know what drove him
don't even ask. Yeah, I just...
And he's probably top 15 of his class and really smart. But
what'd you get in that class? What grade?
I got an A.
Hi, my name is Terrence Davis. I'm a graduate from Central High School and I've enlisted in the United States Army. I do remember entering high school. I wasn't as serious at first, but once I actually sat down and evaluated myself, I was able to grasp that and use that to guide my way through.
How did that change? What changed within you? Was it the instruction? Was it friends? Was it?
Well, really, my father. Really, he helped get me through high school. Just looking at him and the things that he does and his perseverance really, really inspired me to do the same thing.
How could the district better support students?
I would say more counseling. There's one counselor and there's so many different students. So, you know, not every student is going to approach that counselor with the issue that they might have. I think they're not really more counseling, just more counselors, rather, to pinpoint the students. Maybe a minority counselor, maybe a male counselor, female counselor for specific groups.
I think we should have better college-prepared classes, get us, like, what it's going to feel like when we're in college, like the note-taking and the studying and all that.
Do you feel prepared yourself for college?
Yeah, I mean, I consider myself a hard worker, so I feel like I'm going to study and I'm going to take these notes because that's what my mindset is on.
Honestly, I come from a country where there's no support, and I come from Cuba. So it really has, I really do appreciate what JCBS has given me, honestly.
Yeah, we don't need anyone to make us successful. That's just the support for it. I think we are in a perfect position to do whatever we want to do. Where this country has given us free education, there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to be successful.
What do you think your generation's biggest challenge is?
Putting the cell phone down. Generation's biggest challenge is putting the cell phone down because you won't check your online classes or whatever, but you'll check a Facebook or a Twitter, you know what I'm saying, in a heartbeat.
Staying motivated, not sleeping all the time. We depend on technology a lot for everything, and instead of going down the street and saying hey to someone, instead we just pick up our phone and, oh, hey.
I think our generation's biggest challenge is overcoming technology and keeping it from making us lazy, a lazy society.
Do you agree with that?
I agree with that perfectly. If you look at the past generations, like, they have accomplished so much. They wasn't as lazy as us. They studied and put a lot of work into it, and that's why we are where we are right now. If you look at it now, a lot of kids don't study. They stay on Facebook or play outside and
text
stuff
each other.
Yes. Yeah.
My favorite memory of Central High School probably had to be graduation. That probably had to be my best memory.
What was that like?
It was dynamic. It really was. I teared up, and I really didn't think that I would, but I ended up shedding a tear, and it meant a lot to me, especially when I seen my name on that diploma.
It was so weird. I felt like I was like in a dream or something because we're walking down the aisle, and, you know, I've seen other people do it, but I was just like, this is me walking down here. This is so strange. I thought it'd be a lot more sad, but, I mean, I'm ready to move on and go do better things.
I was lucky enough to be born here because my parents immigrated from Senegal. That's where I'm originally from. And I know kids that go through every day who have to walk like 10 kilometers just to have education. Any advice that I would give them is just to just try their best. And in the end, whatever you have or whatever you achieve, you're successful because you at least know that you try your best.
It really just depends on how much you push yourself. And then when you fail, just what attitude you get back up with. Life is 50% chance and 50% of what you make it. So I do say, I know a lot of my friends that have had horrible parents and they have chaotic lives at home and no support whatsoever, but they have such a drive and they've succeeded. They've impressed me, actually. I admire them for being able to pull through that because I've had support, but for people who don't have support, I really think it's just all in you.
A conversation with some graduating Jefferson County Public School students. They spoke with WFPL's Devin Katayama. We're going to take a break. Back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. Some government and other agencies use inmates on work release to perform various tasks around their facilities. In Louisville, some of the workers come from a program overseen by Dismiss Charities. But the Dismiss program has come under scrutiny recently after it was revealed that some inmates with a history of violent crime were allowed to work at the Louisville Zoo, a violation of city policy. Joe Sonka writes about it in a cover story this week in Leo Weekly and joins us now. Hi, Joe. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with a little background on Dismiss. How does this program work?
Well, they're under contract with the Kentucky Department of Corrections to take inmates into their halfway houses. And from there, they work at various organizations, nonprofits, and city agencies within Louisville, free of charge.
So how did the violent offenders end up at the zoo?
Well, it's a bit of a communication error. Both the city and the Louisville Zoo had no idea that they were getting violent offenders. And there have been five in the past few years that have had a violent crime that they were convicted of. And the Louisville Zoo also has an additional requirement that you cannot have a conviction for drug trafficking. And there have also been five over the past 2 years, including two that currently work there that have such a conviction. But these agencies they are under the impression that DSMIS is sending them nonviolent offenders.
Now, we should, I guess, make clear that they were not accused of doing anything wrong during this while working at the zoo, but there are concerns about safety.
Well, there is one, Todd Duke, who was working at the Kentucky Humane Society, and he's been arrested and charged with attempted rape and sodomy of an employee of the Kentucky Humane Society. But what we discovered is that in February of this year, he was actually working at the Louisville Zoo and was transferred over to Kentucky Humane Society. And then we got a list of the inventory of workers that have been working at the zoo over the past few years, and we found additional people that had violent crimes that they were convicted of.
If you're an agency, a nonprofit agency, a government agency, and you take on some of these workers, are there supervision rules that you have to have? Should they be in plain sight all the time?
Yes. These are still inmates, and there are very strict rules in terms of supervision. But what I found at the Louisville Zoo is that most of the DSMIS workers work in the horticultural department, and they mow lawns. And there are large segments of the day where they're totally out of range of supervisors. When I went to the Louisville Zoo last week, I witnessed one of the DSMIS workers cutting the lawns at a far corner of the zoo that was right behind a non-fence subdivision and right next to a parking lot full of school buses of children. And there was no other zoo employee in the area. And that seems to be going against the strict guidelines that are set out in city policy for how these workers are supervised.
Now, of course, you called DSMIS for a response to this. How did they respond to your inquiry?
Well, they are not fans of Leo. Their spokesperson, Bob Yates, says that based on past coverage that Leo's done on DSMIS, that they would not be speaking to us, and he volunteered that Leo is a quote, piece of crap. But that's not really new for DSMIS. They've stonewalled Leo before, and they also stonewalled State Auditor Crit Llewellyn in 2010 when she investigated the exorbitant expenses that this charity that largely relies on tax dollars to operate.
But did they acknowledge that there was a communication breakdown perhaps and that allowed these violent offenders to end up at the zoo?
No, they did not acknowledge it, but I did contact the Kentucky Department of Corrections. And what seems to be the communication breakdown is that DSMIS is contractually obligated to take anyone who the Department of Corrections deems as community custody, meaning they're safe to reenter society as long as they're strictly supervised. But when I asked them about this definition of community custody, oftentimes people who have been convicted of violent crimes towards the end of their term can be deemed community custody. So perhaps the communication breakdown is that the city doesn't know that violent offenders can be under this category.
Now, you talked to the mayor's office and zoo officials. What's been their response to this?
Well, they are upset that DSMIS has sent them people with a violent criminal background. But it doesn't appear that they're going to be cutting off ties with DSMIS. And part of the reason why they might be doing so is that these are people that they don't have to pay. And these are very strict times in terms of the budget. They say that this has worked for many years, and they've not had many instances of crime or an incident like Todd Duke happening. So for now, it looks like they're going to stick with the program.
Well, these inmates are paid. I'm sure it's probably a nominal amount.
Yeah, they're paid by the Department of Corrections 63 cents a day, and the city does not have to pay them anything to perform mostly manual labor around various city agencies.
How did this all come to light? Did somebody come to you? Or?
Yeah, I got a tip that the zoo was working was using DSMIS workers, and it had in fact used Todd Duke earlier this year, and then just a little digging found more people with a violent record.
The name of the cover story is Fail Safe. Dismas Charities puts violent offenders to work at the zoo, raising questions about safety. It's authored by Joe Sanka and this week's Leo Weekly. Joe, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Rick.
This is Byline on WFPL, and we're going to switch gears now and go over some Metro news. And joining us is WFPL political editor Philip Bailey and Erica Peterson, WFPL environment reporter. Welcome, guys.
Thanks, Rick.
Hey, Rick.
All right, Philip, let's start with Kentucky Kingdom / Bluegrass Boardwalk. Bluegrass Boardwalk officials, the Cook family up in Indiana, have signed a lease to operate the park, but now they say it's in such bad condition it won't reopen until 2014. And Ed Hart is speaking up. Of course, he was in long negotiations to reopen the park before the Cook family was brought in.
Yeah, Louisville businessman Ed Hart, who, as you mentioned, Rick, was in the long negotiations with the State Fair Board and the city to reopen Kentucky Kingdom, which closed in late 2009 after Six Flags filed bankruptcy. He's come out publicly and basically said that the responsibility for this, that basically the mayor and the governor have dropped the ball on this matter. He says that, you know, his deal was far superior, that if he had been allowed, or if his deal had gone through, the Kentucky Kingdom would be open now. He also made the allegation, or at least alluded to the fact that the Cook family, you know, they own Holiday World in Santa Claus, Indiana, which has always been, historically speaking, a competitor of Kentucky Kingdom, and they have an incentive for the project not to get off the ground, which is why you've heard reports that if Kentucky Kingdom does reopen, it will not have roller coasters. There's sort of be a water theme park here in the city of Louisville. Mr. Hart has been very public in his criticisms, not only of that deal, but of the state and city leadership in that regard. We talked to Fisher spokesman Chris Pointer about this issue, about what the city could do. He said there was very little the city can do. That its hands are tied because the state owns that property.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the mayor would love to see Bluegrass Boardwalk get open, get the park up and running again. But again, because the city does not own the property and does not control it, it makes it very difficult for us to do anything other than, you know, be a partner through rebate of the occupational taxes. It would be like, you know, it would be like having a neighbor and you wanting the neighbor to improve your house, but you don't own the house.
But is this a failure of leadership on the state's part?
That's a loaded question. I don't answer loaded questions.
Well, do you think, though, that, I mean, if this is the state's land...
I mean, you'd have to ask the state. All I can say is, you know, we have done what we can do for, as far as help from a financial standpoint.
And from Ed Hart's standpoint, he responds to that directly, and he says that really isn't a worthwhile explanation.
Chris Pointer is answering that question as though it's just a monetary question. I think it's a leadership question. I think that when the mayor distances himself from the project saying it's state-owned property, sure it's state-owned property, but it's in the middle of metropolitan Louisville, right across from our international airport. So when people are coming in, they're seeing a dilapidated facility. Besides maybe a modest economic commitment to help the park get open, we were asking the mayor for $300,000 a year to support my $29 million worth of private investment to put 1,000 people to work and to save what was once the state's number one regional attraction in terms of paid visitors. So I don't think it's too much to ask for leadership, i.e. bang the table, maybe light a fire under the butts of some of our local legislators to maybe try to get the legislature engaged to make Kentucky Kingdom into the money-making proposition it was for the city and for the state.
So Ed Hart is essentially just trying to draw out the political leadership here and saying, listen, Kentucky Kingdom was a top attraction, a tourist attraction that made money for the state and for the city. For the city and the state to be pointing fingers at each other to him is unacceptable. Now, there is an ordinance before the Metro Council. The city is doing something. There is an ordinance before the Metro Council that would create a taxing district at the fairgrounds it would give basically Bluegrass Boardwalk partners a rebate on their investments. If approved, that would amount to nearly $50,000 a year in tax incentives for developers. Councilman Kevin Kramer, Republican on the Metro Council, says that they want to do as much as possible to let the Cook family know that they're supportive of them coming to Louisville, and hopefully that'll get them excited enough to get this project off the ground in the next 2 years.
Ed Hart was in negotiations with the state and city and other officials for 18 months for him to reopen the property. What happened? What caused it to break down?
That is still unknown. If you talk to some folks, I mean, sources will say, you know, political observers, that there isn't a great relationship between Mr. Hart, the mayor, and Governor Steve Beshear, that he sort of is not seen as a favorable character by them. Hart says that basically that the conversation just simply ended. When I asked Chris Pointer about that, he said, we don't want to really go back over that and go over the past. No one really wants to comment on specifically what happened. There have been reports that there was an issue about where revenue streams, how it'd be spent, where the revenue streams would go. But the fact that those conversations totally broke down at the end a few months ago, I think has left a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths, particularly Mr. Hart, who says, hey, if I had had the project in my hands, we would have Kentucky Kingdom open presently.
And I guess some might say this is maybe a little sour grapes on his part, saying, you know, I told you so. I told you, you know, this is
I think there's certainly some incentive for Mr. Hart in the sense that, you know, he was involved in the project. He sees himself as someone who has, you know, refurbished theme parks before. So he's coming along really to say, like you said, I told you so. And that there are some difficulties with getting this project off the ground, considering the fact that when you have one of these old amusement parks, the longer it stays closed, the more and more of the cost that rise as far as getting these rides and attractions back up to public safety, as far as public snuff and that aspect. So I think that there is certainly some questions for Mr. Hart as whether he is the person to lead the criticism on this. But I think everyone, from the political leaders to Mr. Hart to everyone involved to folks here who live in Louisville, are a bit disappointed in the fact that Kentucky Kingdom is still closed down.
And we got the official word this week. 2013 is out of the question to reopen.
Yeah, 2014 at the earliest.
All right. Thank you, Philip. I'm going to turn to WFPL environment reporter Erica Peterson to talk a little bit about whiskey fungus, or is it whiskey fungus? Some Louisville residents say a black substance growing on their properties is directly related to whiskey distilling, and they filed a lawsuit. What exactly is this stuff, Erica?
Well, I'm not even going to try to pronounce the scientific name, Rick, because it's it's Latin and long. This is basically a fungus that has it's black, and it's been kind of known to grow near places where whiskey is manufactured. And the lawsuit alleges that this fungus grows when ethanol is released and mixes with moisture, mm-hmm. and it results in this fungus. And the fungus really likes metal surfaces, apparently. So it likes aluminum siding. It likes automobiles. You know, any exposed metal surface.
I see. Now, what are the plaintiffs seeking to get out of the lawsuit?
Well, they want damages. Obviously, they want. They say that the stuff they live near, a distillery or a storage unit for one of three distilleries: Heaven Hill, Brown-Forman, or Diageo. And they say that basically this whiskey fungus has damaged their property. It's near impossible, they say, to get off. So they want some monetary compensation. But they also want the companies to do something about it. The lawyer I spoke to, Bill McMurray, said, you know, there are ways that the companies can kind of control their ethanol output. And this ethanol is what's kind of always been romantically referred to as the angel's share. It's been known that it's been being released from these distilleries forever, ever since they've been making whiskey. And there are ways to control it. It's just not really regulated. You know, it hasn't been really a priority of, you know, for the companies to control it.
What's been the company's response to the suit?
Well, they issued a statement basically just saying that, you know, they're sympathetic to the plaintiff's concerns, but this blackening is due to a naturally occurring common mold that's found widely throughout the environment, including in areas unrelated to the production of whiskey. So they're planning on contesting the claims, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Now, I grew up in Bardstown, popularly known as the bourbon capital of the world, and in between two distilleries, and we just kind of live with this stuff. We like having the jobs and all that kind of stuff, but one would wonder why now? Why the lawsuit now after all these years of distilling?
I could not answer that, mm-hmm. Rick.
And William McMurray is the plaintiff's attorney on this, and he, for those who live around here, know he led the lawsuits, church abuse lawsuits against the Catholic Church.
Yes.
All right, Erica Peterson, we'll be keeping an eye on this litigation. Philip Bailey, back to you. A big announcement this week from Mayor Greg Fisher, going to use some philanthropy money to kind of look ahead and change some or look at how to develop some basic services around the city.
Yeah, people remember that when, you know, Mayor Fisher ran in 2010, I think a big part of his campaign, besides the sort of jobs, jobs, jobs mantra that he repeated often, was the issue or the idea of innovation, bringing innovation to metro government from his business background. $4.8 million is the grant from Bloomberg Philanthropies that the city received last year, one of, I believe, five cities to receive that funds. So together, using those funds, they're going to put together this special team, this innovative delivery team, in fact, that will tackle certain urban problems, issue or projects like expanding the recycling program, reducing the number of low-severity 911 calls, implementing or at least making the rezoning system process more efficient, and also addressing vacant properties. The mayor said that at least their goal is to reduce vacant properties by 40% within 3 years and 67% in 5 years. So this is an ambitious goal. Having national experts come in and be a part of this team as well, talking to different department heads. And it was a pretty stiff competition, too, to get your ideas out to the mayor for among department heads. It's going to be a pretty interesting how this plays out for the city, the idea of having different initiatives and improving city services to this degree.
And where, again, where does this money come from?
Bloomberg Philanthropies, which was started by New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. I believe New Orleans, Chicago, Atlanta were some of the other cities that got the grants last year. Many different cities competed for them, so Louisville was lucky enough to win out. You'll see, I believe, some issues already are put into this fiscal plan that Fisher came out with, such as the 95-gallon, which you'll see in the pilot program in two neighborhoods for the recycling bins. So sort of similar to the trash cans we already have now. Mm-hmm. There'll be larger recycling bins, which the mayor says will encourage more recycling. You'll see, I think $90,000 has been put into the budget for a nurse who will sort of deal with non-emergency 911 calls, sort of to reduce ambulance calls. Sometimes people do call 911 for a sore throat and have an ambulance run them to the yeah. emergency room, which costs the taxpayer money. So it'll be interesting to see, I think, how this innovative team will, you know, implement certain ideas and initiatives and get that ball rolling, and how this $4.8 million will be used. It has to be matched by the city now as well. So if there's city mm-hmm. money involved in it, it's not just the Bloomberg grant involved.
All right. Thank you, Philip. And we're going to wrap up with you, Erica. We're going to go from whiskey fungus to a tulip tree scale, as tulip poplars are especially vulnerable this summer because of an influx of an insect called the tulip tree scale. What's the insect do, and why are there so many of them this year?
Well, this is basically something that's been around for a long time in the Ohio River Valley, and it's never really posed that much of a problem. But the past two winters here have been pretty mild. And usually the winters, you know, when it gets down below freezing, it kills off a significant amount of the tree scale insect. That hasn't happened. So now there are just tons of these insects. And basically what they do is they attach themselves, their favorite tree is the tulip poplar, they attach themselves to the bark, and they basically suck the sap out. And they release this substance that's commonly called honeydew. It's like a clear, sugary substance. So people have been noticing a lot of that, perhaps on their cars, on their driveways, and that's a nuisance. But the real danger is to the tulip poplar, because with all these insects sucking their sap out, it obviously weakens them a lot. And the tulip poplar is already, it's a very drought-sensitive tree. And we're predicting a pretty dry, hot summer up ahead, and which means the tulip poplar under normal conditions would be really greatly weakened by this. And when you add the scale insect, it really kind of intensifies the chances that a tulip poplar could die.
What can people do to protect the trees?
Well, there are pesticides for it, but those are best applied early on in spring. At this point, the biologist I talked to basically said the best thing people can do is water their trees, make sure it gets enough water, and then you just hope that it's not, you know, weakened by drought as well as by the scale insect.
All right. WFPL Environment reporter Erica Peterson and WFPL political editor Philip M. Bailey, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rick.
Have a nice weekend. We're going to turn our attention now to horse racing and the Belmont Stakes, which is a week from tomorrow. And for the first time in a number of years, there is a contender for the Triple Crown. I'll Have Another has won the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness Stakes and will vie for a Triple Crown, the Racing's a Triple Crown. Be the first winner of the Triple Crown since Affirm did it in 1978. And here to talk about it is Ed DeRosa, who writes for Brisnet.com Racing Information Service and also is a blogger for TwinSpires.com. Ed, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Really looking forward to next week.
Yeah, it's very exciting. How are the preparations going for I'll Have Another?
Well, he actually had a little bit of a scare yesterday. He was training at Belmont Park out for what they call a gallop, which isn't a full workout, but stretching his legs and getting his daily exercise. And a horse was loose on the track and actually brushed I'll Have Another. no injuries to either horse, but I can't imagine what was racing through trainer Doug O'Neill's mind as he saw a loose horse heading toward his Kentucky Derby winner. Harrowing moments for sure. Luckily, no one hurt, but added a little bit of excitement to what normally is a routine gallop.
Otherwise, he's training well?
Yeah, from all reports, I haven't seen him since he left from the Derby, but people I trust who have seen him every day say he's held his weight very well. That's always a concern with horses running a little more often than we're used to seeing them, but he's held his weight. He's eating all his food. That's a big indicator. So all signs are pointing to him firing his best shot on Saturday, and if it's good enough, he'll enter Racing Immortality.
I know it's early yet, but is there any indication as to how many horses will be in the Belmont field?
Yeah, we're looking at about 11. We were sitting at a dozen yesterday, but one of them spiked a fever, and his trainer said that he didn't think he'd be able to train him up to the race. That was Alpha, who had run in the Kentucky Derby after running in New York. So he's out, but there's still 10 others looking to dethrone. I'll have another from the top perch, and it's actually a pretty good field. Union Rags was one of the favorites for the Derby. He's coming back for the Belmont. And Dullahan, trained by Dale Romans, a trainer I'm sure a lot of Louisville people are familiar with if they head to the Downs. We'll have Dullahan. He finished third in the Derby after winning the Bluegrass here at Keeneland. So he's sort of the Kentucky connections hope, and he's owned by a bunch of guys from Iowa. So he'll be carrying the Midwest banner out east.
Now, I have another overtook Bodemeister in both the Derby and the Preakness. Will Bodemeister be in the Belmont?
No, Bodemeister sitting this one out, but to add a little intrigue, his owner and trainer entering another horse, Painter, who ran on Preakness Day. He won a race earlier on the day before I'll have another won the Preakness. But Ahmed Zayed and trainer Bob Baffert decided they want to point towards some summer targets with Bodemeister. They feel he's seen enough of Al of Another passing him at the wire, but they're going to try to take another run at Al of Another with Painter.
Now, it's been 1978, the last Triple Crown winner affirmed did it. What's made it so difficult for horses to win it over the years?
I think a big part of it is two things. I think we saw with horses like Silver Charm and Real Quiet, they just ran, and Sunday Silence, those three ran into horses who were as good as them. And to beat a rival who's as good as you three times in a row while traveling to three different tracks, very difficult. So I think that was in play for those horses. Then when you get to horses like Smarty Jones and Funny Side, one of the things we've seen in recent years is horsemen don't necessarily view the Triple Crown is a unit. It's not a race where they feel like they have to run in all three once they commit to running in the Derby. So what we get are horses firing fresh in the Belmont, like Union Rags and Dullahan, who skipped the Preakness. In 2002 and 2004, it was Empire Maker. 2003 and 2004, it was Empire Maker and Birdstone, two horses who had run in the Derby, skipped the Preakness, and then won the Belmont to deny a Triple Crown. So those two things have sort of conspired against. I don't think the drought means it can't be done, but I do think it means it has gotten harder.
Now, the Belmont is the longest of the three races. Will that work, and I'll have another advantage?
Yeah, I think so. It's one of those rare instances. A lot of times we're talking about horses who can't get the distance. It's something we hear a lot about with the Derby at a mile and a quarter. And then when you add that extra quarter mile in the Belmont, it definitely makes a big difference. And some people think that's one of the things that contributed to Smarty Jones and Funny Side both getting beat. But Al of Another should have no problem with the extra quarter mile. His sire, Flower Alley, who stands at Three Chimneys near Lexington, won the Traverse Stakes, which is a mile and a quarter, and finished second in the Breeders' Cup Classic at Belmont Park. So it seems like the pedigree is there not only to like the distance but also the racetrack.
Now, I have another's trainer Doug O'Neill's been the focus of some controversy. He's gotten into some disciplinary problems in California. What's going on with that?
Right now, we're waiting to see what becomes of the suspension that they've handed down. He will be able to saddle. I'll have another in the Belmont. There's no effect to his training over the next couple weeks. The one thing I think hasn't quite been illustrated well enough, as his story's been told, is, and I don't say this to excuse him because certainly there were violations and breaking the rules deserves to be punished, but he has not been charged with anything so nefarious to the point that these are substances that should never be in a horse. They are legal under certain situations, such as when a horse isn't racing and is only in training. So to me, it's not quite as bad as some have made it out to be, but absolutely he's had violations. I view it more as pushing the envelope than straight up cheating. But either way, it hasn't reflected well on the sport of Kings, that's for sure.
And for those who don't know, this is what's known as milkshaking, is that right?
Yeah, the violation that's come up most recently is milkshaking, which I think comes from being a bicarbonate and sort of looks like a frothy beverage if you were to view it, before you give it to the horse. But it's to encourage blood flow and oxygen exchange and just help the horse perform more efficiently as it runs its heart out. And it occurs naturally in all of us. It's a physiological thing. But when you give a horse a milkshake, when you add to what is already naturally occurring in their system, it elevates certain blood counts, and they're able to test for it, and that's what he's been accused of doing.
All right, Ed DeRosa with Brisnet.com. Ed, you'll be at the Belmont next week?
Yep, looking forward to it. Flying out Friday morning, couple great days of racing, and really hoping to see a Triple Crown winner. I haven't been alive for one, and if you're a horse racing fan, this is sort of your world championship or Final Four to be able to experience it. So hopefully I'll finally get the pleasure.
It's been a long time coming. Maybe we'll see one next week.
Looking forward to
it. Ed DeRosa, Brisnet.com and TwinSpires.com, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Byline on WFPL. We now want to welcome in Kenny Colston, Kentucky Public Radio Frankfort Bureau Chief, to kind of update us on what's been going on in Frankfort, even though the legislature's not in session. Still a lot going on with the state government. Welcome back, Kenny.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with State Auditor Adam Edlin. He says he will audit some of managed care providers. Explain that.
Yeah, basically what it is something we've talked about many of times, the statewide managed care providers, the Coventry Cares, Kentucky Spirit, and WellCare. And the auditor kind of took a look earlier this year when the legislature was taking a look as well and took kind of an initial look at those three groups and said, you know, here's some recommendations for you all, for the state, for healthcare providers, do these, and in the meantime, I'm going to set up a Medicaid task force to make sure that you all are actually following the rules and going along with these recommendations. Well, since that time, there's been a lot of news. It seems like every Friday we're talking about how Coventry Cares or another group is having a problem, Coventry being the biggest one, wanting to renegotiate contracts. And so when I caught up with Auditor Edelin, and I said, you know, you've got your task force, you've taken a look at this, what's your next step? You know, are you thinking about an audit? And he said, yes, I am going to audit the three statewide managed care organizations, because what's going on is not protecting the consumer, it's not protecting patients, and it's not helpful to doctors.
Now, this concept of managed care brought in by the governor as a cost-cutting measure, right?
Yeah, pretty much. And you see it in other states. Ohio, you know, has managed care. And so it's not an entirely new concept. In the Louisville area, there's been managed care for 14, 15 years with Passport. People just didn't realize what it was. And it is to cut savings. I mean, Medicaid is one of the largest parts of Kentucky's budget, one of the largest parts of the federal budget. So managed care is basically you're taking state resources out of managing Medicaid every day. You're handing it over to private companies, and they're dealing with it, and they're supposed to do cost savings. The problem is Kentucky has such a large Medicaid population in the east and the west, there may not be actual enough room to do savings in those areas.
Now, Passport, as you mentioned, has done well in terms of cost savings. There have been some controversies there as well. But now we understand that the Louisville Medicaid region is going to be opening up for outside business, right?
Pretty much. The newest thing with the federal government and the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare is competition in your managed care regions. Passport hasn't been subject to that. They were founded 14 years ago by a bunch of different U of L hospitals in a bunch of different areas. And you're right. You know, Passport's been so successful that they've squandered, you know, millions of dollars and still save the state millions of dollars. So what's happening now is that the Cabinet for Health and Family Services has decided, the federal government said you must have competition in Region 3, which is the Louisville area, which is Passport's region. So the state government has said, Passport, you have 6 more months to the end of this year to operate, you know, exclusively. You're welcome to bid, but come, you know, January 1st, this will be an open region. You will not have exclusive rights. And they're taking bids now. As we already talked about previously, United Healthcare is wanting to get involved here. It's no secret that some of these statewide, Coventry Cares, Kentucky Spirit, they want to get in the Louisville region because it's a good region to operate in, a lot of doctors, a lot of hospitals, and it's profitable.
And finally, let's talk about ALEC. It's been in the news quite a bit now. You can explain what it is. But there is a progressive group that's targeting some Kentucky members of this organization.
Right. The ALEC is the American Legislative Exchange Council, and they've really come out under fire since the Trayvon Martin shooting in Florida because ALEC is known to push what's called the Stand Your Ground law that was so prominent in that case and is prominent in that case. And so a lot of Democratic and liberal groups have pushed back against ALEC. They've had a lot of corporate members of the group, you know, basically push them to give it up. Walmart was the latest one, Yum Brands, Amazon. Now, the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, the PCCC, is pushing, you know, the other side of it, state lawmakers. And it's something we've covered a lot here the past couple of weeks. And basically, they're pushing the remaining Democratic ALEC members in Kentucky to drop their membership. It's a, you know, a handful of state senators. 4 have already dropped their membership. They want the other 6 to drop their membership. And so they're running online ads and having their supporters phone bank to encourage those remaining Democratic state senators to drop ALEC membership.
All right. Kenny Colston is the Capital Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio. Kenny, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with Aaron Keene in just a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Howlett, and this is the segment of the program where we're joined by Aaron Keene, WFPL Arts and Humanities reporter. Aaron, welcome back.
Thanks, Rick.
Talking about some theater productions going on this weekend in Louisville, and we're going to begin with Theater 502 opening its new season with what you call, I love this word, dystopian play about the death of print. What's it called? What's going on?
The play is called Futura, like the typeface, and like it absolutely sounds like a dystopian future where, you know, the things which are supposed to improve us as a society become actually more controlling and repressive as they're enacted. Futura is a play by Jordan Harrison, and Louisville theater goers know him from his work in past Humana festivals at Actors Theater. He's done world premieres of a number of his plays here. So, but what Theater 502 does is they don't necessarily do world premieres. They want those second and third and fourth productions, those of hot new playwrights. And so this Futura debuted in 2010, hasn't been on the scene very long. But the premise is that in the not so distant future, there are no more books, everything's digital. Sound familiar?
Yes.
You know, maybe we're heading that way. But not only that, then they take it a step further. And not only are there no more physical books, all books have been merged into one gigantic file in the cloud called the Great Collection. And not just books, but any written material. We're talking love letters, shopping lists, emails to your friends. So handwriting and actually print is outlawed. And so what we do in this play is we meet the resistance, the folks who are fighting this intellectually and perhaps through other more strange and in-your-face tactics.
And we go from dystopian to surreal because the Alley Theater for Young Americans is staging a kids' play at the Speed Museum. What's that?
Yeah, the Young Audiences project of that. The Alley Theater does stuff like, you know, the Star Wars in 60 seconds or less. I'm making that up, but not really. They do a lot of pop culture parodies. They have a Gilligan's Island musical on right now, but they have a children's theater component as well. And this is a play called This Is Not a Pipe Dream, and it's about the childhood of Belgian surrealist painter René Magritte. And they're staging it at the Speed Art Museum, which is a great little partnership, I think. An interesting way to make great art come alive for kids with a stage play. And then the Speed doesn't have any Magritte work in their collection, but they do have a nice surrealist collection. So you come to the show, you also get museum admission. You can go kind of check out the surrealists and see how those stage concepts kind of come to life. They use a lot of magic tricks in the show because
it's a surreal play about a surreal artist. So things have to appear, things have to levitate in that same way that they do in Magritte's paintings.
And we've got about a minute left. I want to devote this to Looking for Lilith, the Louisville tradition, now 10 years old.
Yeah, Louisville's Feminist Theater Collective is Looking for Lilith. They're celebrating their 10th anniversary with a review of some of their favorite original plays. They create original work based on interviews with women, and they write plays about women's history and women's perspectives. So they have a review of some of the scenes from some of their favorites, but they also have a new play called Becoming Mothers that's all about the changing face of pregnancy, motherhood, birth, consumer culture surrounding it, all of that.
All right. We're looking forward to all of these productions, and a happy anniversary to Looking for Lilith Theater. Erin Keene, thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you next Friday.
Thanks, Rick.
That's all the time we have for today's program. Byline is produced by the WFPL News staff, our production team led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. Special thanks for technical support to Joe Durso. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.